Nehemiah chapter 4. We are looking at the last section here, last few verses. And we're going to read just a little bit here to kind of get our minds back to where we were. As the people are working on the wall, stationed around the wall, prepared for battle, no less, not knowing what their enemy may try to do. So now they're doing work on the wall. The laborers are exhausted, as we have seen, and yet they're willing to fight for what they're trying to do and accomplish. Verse 16, from that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears and shields and bows and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, and each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars come out. At that time, I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve as guards by night and workmen by day. Neither I nor my brothers nor men, my men nor guards with me took off their clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. So there again, we get a picture again of just what's happening and where they are and what they're doing. And we talked some Sunday about Nehemiah's leadership with regard to unity, that he inspired unity among the people, a willingness to work together hand in hand. And there's applications we can make with that, even with the church. We talked some about that on Sunday. I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, we did talk about that some on Sunday. And then unity is this, it's a God-given commandment, really, from God with regard to the church. And it's amazing, as we've seen and as we talked about, what can happen, what can be accomplished when people work together. On the bottom of page 13, this is on lesson 7. What can we learn about unity from these passages? We started kind of working our way through some of these passages right here. How the Christians, the new Christians in Jerusalem, were of one heart and one soul. You know, they had the same conviction in Christ. And it lent itself to good things happening and work being done. Romans chapter 14 tells us that attitude matters. You know, our attitude makes a difference in what we can do and what we can accomplish. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10, you know, how painful it was for Paul to have to see and to identify that there was divisions even among those who were supposed to be of the same mind. And he was pleading with them to not have divisions among them. Ephesians chapter 4 is where we are picking up in our study here tonight. Ephesians chapter 4. And again, we're just looking at some important points regarding unity. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1 says, I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Look, we're looking here at these passages about what can we learn about unity. What comments can we make about unity from these passages? So we look here at Ephesians chapter 4, and what comments come to mind? What do we need to see? And what do we need to implement? What is it teaching us? Bless.
It seems to me that what's being said is that unity starts with an attitude of submission towards one another, an attitude of lowliness and meekness. And when we have that attitude towards the Scriptures, then we're submitting to God ultimately. First and foremost, and when we submit to God, then all the other things line up because that's our first priority. was submitted to God, we have a vertical relationship, correct, and then the horizontal things tend to take care of themselves.
When we are looking and striving for unity among brethren, we can never get too far away from the attitude, the issue of attitude, and what can be accomplished. Rick.
One thing that occurs to me is that unity has to be based on something. I mean, a lot of people will call for unity, mm-hmm. but without any just unity and diversity, you've heard, that they want to be unified, but the only way they can do that is to just forget about any facts or anything such as that or any basis.
You have to compromise to try to find unity in diversity, though that seems like an oxymoron to me. Unity in diversity, how can that even be? And, of course, we don't find that here in the text. What else? Gene?
In following on to Rick's comments, in following the next verses in Ephesians chapter 4, defines that unity.
I think so.
Very, very specifically.
Yes.
There is one body, one faith, one spirit, one God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's where it takes us next. Unity can be found. God has designed the church in such a way where there can be unity, but we're going to have to be on the same playing field to be able to get there and to find that. The next text here, in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 12 and 13, where this whole chapter is kind of leading, to this point. In chapter 4, verse begin verse 11, actually, where it says that Christ gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. What does that mean? What is that saying? What does that have to do with unity? How does that fall into place here?
I don't know if this is where you're going at all, but each individual has a union with God. And if our union with God is correct, then our union with each other is going to be correct.
It's going to be correct too. And part of the responsibilities of those who would be evangelists, pastors, and teachers is to work and to teach the church in such a way that they can become perfected or equipped, some versions might say, for the work of service, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And it's telling us that indeed, yes, there can be unity that is found, but it's going to have to come from a common source. I mean, even as this text goes forward, as it goes on here a little bit farther, verse 15, speaking the truth in love may grow up into all things, into him who is the head. Verse 16, from whom the whole body joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Unity can be found. Unity can be attained. But it's going to have to come from the same source. We're going to have to be of the same mind. Yes?
As I have opportunity from time to time to look at sermons and Sunday morning services of other congregations of various sorts out there, one of the trends that I see from that is more of an experiential kind service. Very emphasized, not all vocal, instrumental, really. Mm-hmm. And other things that don't necessarily relate to
speaking the truth in love.
The knowledge of, where we see the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God.
Right.
The thing that's missing a lot of times in those kinds of services, among other things, is the teaching of the knowledge of Christ.
Yeah.
And that's where it really has to be far as unity in the truth.
Sure.
If we don't start with the knowledge of the Bible, the knowledge of Christ, then there's no hope that they're ever being unified.
True. Very true. We're just bouncing on several passages here, just trying to pull off a few points that help us to understand some things about unity. Look at Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. Paul, writing to this church that he loves, says some things here in these first four verses that really throws the idea of unity right out here in the forefront. And it has a whole lot to do with attitude, going back to Les's point here at the beginning. And then uses Christ as the example of the attitude that we should have. But in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 2, therefore, if there's any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. I mean, here's the attitude that we need to have. Here's what we're striving for, being of the same mind. Unity can be found, but we're going to have to be of the mind and the desire to find that. Look at chapter 4. Chapter 4 and verse 2. Look, I mean, today sometimes among Christians there is a struggle to find unity. Not a new issue. Philippians 4 verse 2 in the kind of closing part of the letter. I beg Euodia and I beg Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. I don't know what the problem was or what the issue was, but here the apostle is saying, please, please, can't you be of the same mind? You know, there's some points, there's some lessons to be learned, you know, from these things. What are your thoughts? Other comments?
Can we be the brothers and sisters of Christ can be of the same mind is to take for ourselves the mind.
Mm-hmm.
You have an idea. I have an idea. I think this means this. You think it means that. If we have the mind of Christ, mm-hmm. we'll have unity
right.
and harmony. But if we're fighting against each other, we won't.
That's right. Brent.
I think that the word to look for is to, that we have the same purpose.
Mm-hmm.
If all of us have the same purpose, it's not going to be about us. It's going to be about glorifying Christ and everything.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Let's look at the next page here on page 14, second part of the lesson. We are looking once again here at application. You know, what can we learn from the story here of Nehemiah? Some application, even today, and in the Lord's church. You know, when we look at the story here of Nehemiah, we see that Nehemiah's leadership inspired unity. I mean, there just seems to be one opportunity after another that could have just led to division and problem and arguing and separating of ways. But he had some ability about him to inspire unity. So much so that they were all willing to work hand in hand, even when it seems, as we might say, the odds were against them. The enemy was outside the gate. The work was exhausting. It was seemingly was more that could be to do than what could possibly be done. All of these things seemed to be against them. And yet somehow Nehemiah had a great part to do here in keeping them focused on doing the work that was before them. You know, sometimes we just really need to think about their diligence and their willingness to work and see how that can apply to us. Some questions, some thought questions here for us to work on. You know, even though they were working with some great obstacles, you know, carrying swords and bows, you know, to be very prepared for a battle while they're building the wall, nonetheless, they continued to work. The question, what does it take for the church to demonstrate that same kind of willingness to work? What's it going to take?
As you were reading at the beginning of the class this chapter here, it reminded me of Ephesians chapter 6, when the Apostle Paul said, stand firm, therefore, having girded your loins with truth, and put on the breastplate of righteousness. And he goes on and describes the armor that we're to put on and the sword that we're to have, which is the They weren't taking off their clothes. They were ready 24/7 with their sword in their hand. We have to figuratively not take off our armor.
Right.
We have to have our sword in our hands 24/7. We have to be ready 24/7 just as they were.
For whatever Satan may have to throw against us. As we've seen the story of the Jews rebuilding the wall in Nehemiah, you know, Satan kept their enemy, kept coming back, you know, with different efforts to try to stop, you know, what they were doing. They had to be ready for that. You know, there has to be, among the Lord's people, a willingness to get along. Maybe even more than that, just a desire to get along. Something within us that says we want to get along. And sometimes people have a lot of different agendas. And if you notice, sometimes churches that seem to be continually plagued with problems, there's a lot of different agendas that come into mind. But if we are all working to God's agenda, well, that just narrows things down a lot, doesn't it? Where we have more of a common goal. And so what does it take for a church to demonstrate that kind of willingness to work? Well, we've got to be working to God's agenda. Other thoughts? Look at the next point. Unity becomes a key factor in the success of this work. What is the role of leaders to encourage this kind of success? And how do they do that? What can we learn from Nehemiah? You know, to find success at building unity, success in keeping, you know, a church headed in the same direction. What is the role of leaders to encourage this? What'd you come up with? Les?
This effort has a lot of results and consequences, and they're all good because the Lord's blessings are going to come from doing His work and rebuilding the law, rebuilding the temple.
And there was that continual reminder to them too, even here in verse 14, where he says, "Remember the Lord who is great and awesome." You know, that they were doing what the Lord wanted them to do and accomplish. I mean, sometimes, don't you think, we just have to stop and be reminded what we are supposed to be doing? I mean, that's what Nehemiah was doing. He was reminding them of what they were supposed to be doing and that God was on their side, that this was what God wanted them to do. That's an important point to keep in mind, Zach.
He also, in verse 19, laid out,
yeah.
Everybody knows what to do.
Yeah,
in that
that's
situation.
Right. Knows how to respond.
It's not going to be total pandemonium.
Right. Right. There was a plan.
A good leader like Nehemiah, as you can see, he was a selfless person.
Mm-hmm.
So he, being that kind of person, would rub off on the people around him so that self gets out of the way.
I think this becomes a key point as we talk more about leaders as this goes on. I think that's right. Earl?
Just to the idea of the role of leaders, Nehemiah, as it relates to Nehemiah, a good leader has to lead by example, and they have to be willing to do, they have to be willing to get down in the trenches with the soldiers and fight alongside of them, not stand up on the podium somewhere and look down on people.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to begin there with him.
Yeah.
And Nehemiah is a great.
We've seen that with Nehemiah over and over again. Rick.
You made me think of an English professor I had when I first started back in school and college. And he was apparently angry at God because he always had something contrary to say about the Bible or Christians or things.
Yeah.
We come to services and join together because we need to be reminded. We need to be encouraged. And that's what studying the Word and gathering together does. It reminds us who we are, who we're supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was a ridiculous statement. I agree with it.
We read a few moments ago from Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1. Remember where he says, I beseech you to walk worthy of the calling of which you were called. You know, we need that reminder. You know, are we walking as we should walk? Are we paralleling Christ, so to speak, in the way we live, in the way we walk? Yes, we have to be reminded of that. And Nehemiah had to remind the Jews rebuilding the wall time and again what the objective was and what they had to do. All right? Good points. Let's see. You know, when we see the work that's before us, speaking of Christians now, making application, the New Testament church, when we see the work before us, you know, such as is said in our text, from that day on, here was the plan, from that day on, they continued to do this work. Make application. When we see the work before us, what are we going to do? I mean, Nehemiah had to kind of regroup these Jewish workers on the wall to help them refocus. What are we going to do? Let's make it different. Make it real. What's the application? What do we see?
To every individual person to do their part. And you can't sit around and say, well, they'll do it. They'll take care of it. Somebody else will handle that.
Everyone was joining hand in hand to do the task that was before them.
We've all heard this expression that says when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Uh-huh. Or that's what they were facing, wasn't it? And churches face that too. You know, even if there's a period of time where a church has peace and there's not any problems, it's just waiting to happen. Satan will make sure that there's going to be some difficulty that comes that can easily cut the feet out from underneath the church. But that's when the tough have to get tough and get going.
It's probably those times of peace when a church is most at risk.
Absolutely.
They get lazy.
Absolutely.
The preacher will take care of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what some say. All right. Good points. So Nehemiah's leadership inspired unity, a willingness to work hand in hand. But then down about the middle of the page, Nehemiah was confident. He wasn't confident in himself, no. There wasn't any cockiness about Nehemiah. His confidence was, our God will fight for us. Remember that? That was the text. When he reminded them, our God will fight for us. I'm wondering sometimes if we have the same level of confidence. Because issues will come, problems will come, there'll be troubles. You know, in our personal lives, in our church life, church family, there will be problems that come. God will fight for us. And so let's think here about some points, about how we should have some confidence in this and how we should find some relief knowing that God is on our side. But even the godly have to be reminded sometime that the battle is the Lord. We sing a song sometime about that. The battle is the Lord's. And I really think we have to be reminded of that. And that's what was happening with Nehemiah. I mean, it one issue after another seems to come up, and there's more coming as we get farther into the text. There's more issues coming. It's not all issues from outside. If you read through chapter 5 already, there's some internal issues that's about to spring up. Yeah, one right after another. And so there has to be this reminder and this pulling together that you know, the battle is the Lord's. And we have to look to him to help us work through some of these things. Okay, let's make some comments here on some of these passages here. Exodus chapter 14. Go with me here to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14 and verse 12. You know, we just try to imagine here for a moment. We step back in time to the children of Israel. and looking at leaving Egypt, as bad as they wanted to leave Egypt, we imagine what an overwhelming concern that would be and cause. Moses is a leader at this point, of course. Exodus chapter 14 and verse 12, where it says, let's go to verse 11, he says, they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us out to this desert to die? What have you done to us bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Verse 13. Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring this day. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again." It's a powerful statement by Moses as he says, don't be afraid of what our enemies can do. Stand firm. You're going to see the power of God. You're going to see the hand of God as he delivers you. You know, sometimes I think we need that reminder too. I mean, individually, collectively, as we see sometimes the way Satan is working against us and the things that he brings against us, sometimes we just need to be reminded, you know, let's just stand for what's right. Let's step back and let's see what God's going to do about this. You know, I can get pretty concerned about just the direction some things are going in society and just where our country is going, and there's reason for concern about those things. But in the big picture, sometimes we've just got to stand back and let's see what the power of God's going to do. You know, there's a message there that we need to be able to see. You know, there are words of defeat and there are words of victory. Which are going to be ours? And we can make applications with that individually and as a church as well. Words of defeat or words of victory, which will it be? You know, Nehemiah had that ability to keep everybody focused and looking at what was the will of God and reminding them that the grace of God was with them, that God was on their side. Moses was doing the same thing. And even in the church, we need leaders who can stand up and say, you know, the battle is the Lord's. You know, the Lord is going to sort this out. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. I'm not saying it's going to be good or easy on us. But in the end, the Lord will sort these problems out. Because he always has. He's always done that. So, you know, the confidence of Nehemiah is something that needs to kind of rub off on us. Our God will fight with us, Nehemiah said. A couple of other passages we can look at too. You got any comments? Gene?
Both Moses and Nehemiah used almost exactly the same words. The Lord will fight for us.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I think that's not by accident. You know, there's some power in what's being said here. Deuteronomy chapter 20 is where we're going. Deuteronomy chapter 20. As Moses' days are coming to an end, what we find really in the book of Deuteronomy is kind of a review of all the things that God has done for the last 40 years for the children of Israel as Moses has been leading them. But Moses is not going into the promised land, but reminds them of some of these events and the promises of God. Promises in blessings if they obey. You'd have to also say promises of God of condemnation if they fail to obey him. That promise is just as strong. And here in chapter 20, he says, verse 1, "When you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them, because the Lord your God, who brought you up out of Egypt, will be with you." What's he talking about here? I mean, there would be a lot of physical battles the children of Israel would have to deal with. You know, as they go in and conquer the land. So what's this point here, this reference to how they view their enemy? What's the point? Say it again.
No enemy is larger than God.
Yeah, yeah. No enemy is larger than God. Rick?
He just, not too long ago, led them to the Red Sea and conquered the Egyptians. And that's, he's kind of pointing back to that. Mm-hmm. The Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.
Yeah, how did you get here?
Yeah, remember where you were.
Yeah, the power of God demonstrated in a phenomenal way. And as they entered into the land, there would be battles that they would have to fight. Enemies that would come in from afar. That, I mean, from a strategic kind of standpoint. I mean, if you were the guy who was kind of standing back saying, who's going to win this battle? I don't know that anybody would ever choose the Lord's army. Because some of the battles that were fought were the armies with many more people and horses and chariots when the Lord's people didn't have that. But when they were obeying God and when they were obeying God and God was with them, those two go hand in hand always. It didn't matter how great the army was of their enemy. The people of God always came out ahead. That's what Moses was saying. He was reminding them or telling them of these things before those events actually happened or take place. Because the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt will be with you. Sometimes we just have to be reminded of that. Because we face battles too. Individually and as churches, we face battles too. But we have to remember that if we are on God's side, He is on ours, and we'll always come out ahead. What are the thoughts?
The final battle that we're going to face as Christians is when we face death. And back in Exodus, the passage you read just a minute ago, we read that when Moses said to them, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord." That would be, a very encouraging passage to share with somebody who's on their deathbed.
Yeah.
Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord.
Yeah.
You're at death's door, but you stand by and watch. God's going to take this and He's going to provide for you. How encouraging that kind of passage would be.
That's a powerful point. Rick?
It makes me think of Romans 8:31-32. But then shall we say to these things, if God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things?
Mm-hmm. If God is for us, who can be against us? I think verse 39 says it. Powerful. Okay. Let's look at one more. 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. We're going to begin reading at verse 45 where we find the young shepherd boy facing off with the giant, the soldier, Goliath. And how for days the soldiers of the Israelites had cowered and were afraid to come out against the Philistines, afraid to come out against Goliath. And here this little shepherd boy comes out and just puts things in perspective. You know, when he says here, 1 Samuel 17, verse 45, David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut your head off. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All these gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give all of you into our hands." Verse 48. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Amazing. Sometimes we read something like that and we think, that's just amazing that this little shepherd boy would have such power. No. It's not so much about the shepherd boy. The battle belongs to the Lord. And that's what the shepherd boy was saying. That's what David was saying. The battle is the Lord's, and he will give you all into our hands. I think Gary told you about this already while I was gone, but when we went to Israel, this was one of the most emotional places that we went to, that valley of Elah, where you can stand between the mountains, the hills, there where the Israelites were on one side and the Philistines were on the other. You didn't do that one yet? Okay. All right. And I have no time to say much. What a powerful place to be, emotional place to be. You stand there in the brook. It was dried up at the time. But in the brook there where it was like the dividing line between the Israelites and the Philistines. And where David picked up his stone and slew the giant right there. And you can't help but think of this passage. And it just, I keep just reading this over and over again. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. That's what Nehemiah kept telling the children of Israel. What he kept telling the Jews rebuilding the wall. He wasn't using those words specifically, but he said the same thing over and over again. The grace of God is with us. His hand is with us. You know, he kept saying these things over and over again. And somehow as Christians today, as the Lord's church assembles, we still need to hear these things. We still need to hear these same points and realize that God is with us. If we will be his people, if we will submit to him, the battle is not ours, it's the Lord's. And he will help us sort our way through life. Nehemiah was good at being able to put that in perspective. We need to be able to put that in perspective too, that our God will fight for us. Closing comments here. Our time is just about gone. Daryl.
All these things that reminds me from our reading this week, and this is again, you know, talking about, I think this is from when Paul's talking about his thorn in the flesh. 2 Corinthians 12:9, and he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you can make the same point again, that really and truly the battle was the Lord's, and the Lord will give strength, where we can overcome issues and difficulties in life. He's always done that for his people, and he does that for us today too. We just need to be reminded of that. Lord willing, on Sunday, we're going to spend just a few minutes here on the very bottom of this page, Nehemiah, leader with dirty hands. We'll kind of close out some remarks here on chapter 4. And if you don't have it, I think most of you do now, lesson 8. We're getting into chapter 5. And, you know, I spend a lot of time making up these handouts here, these outlines. I sure wish you'd read those things over, son. You know, help you get your thoughts together. You know, as you read through the text and just think about some things we can discuss. And Lord willing, Sunday morning, that's where we're going. Lesson 8, that's Nehemiah chapter 5. Good comments tonight. Appreciate your good comments on that.